Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So Jason Riley, Lakin Riley's father, spoke for the first time. He sat down for an interview with the Today Show and had this to say. First, just about his daughter, speaking from the perspective of her dad.
We were looking forward to seeing her graduate next year. She was so full of life. I just hate that, you know, she was taken so early. I wake up every day thinking, you know, that I can call her, and I can't.
And then, of course, he was asked the question that is obvious given how much profile her beating death has received, which is, you know, what do you think? If the laws were different, could this have been prevented?
We have no idea if that would have changed anything, but he's here illegally, that he might not have been here had we had secure borders.
And on this matter of her beating death becoming a national political issue.
I feel like she's being used somewhat politically.
How do you feel about that?
It makes me angry. She was much better than that. She should be raised up for the person that she is.
Yeah, I mean, I'm not going to quibble with a dad's grieving over the loss of his daughter, but I think she is being raised up. I think one of the reasons that the case has generated so much attention is because she is being raised up for the life that she led, the life that was taken away from her, and the context in which it was. This was a young woman, by all accounts, doing things the right way, playing by the rules, pursuing her interest in becoming a nurse. And then you have an interloper who shouldn't have been in this country in a position to do the horrific acts that he allegedly did. And so, you can call it a political football if you want, or you can say she's being used politically if you want. But the way that we understand issues before us is to take the abstract and make it concrete. And stories like the Lakin Riley murder help to, I think, make it concrete in the minds of Americans about just what exactly is on the line here when we talk about border security. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
Yeah, I mean, she was dedicating her life to serving others. She wanted to be work with children, be a nurse in a pediatrician's office. And, you know, the big headline from mainstream media that I kept seeing all day is her murder is being used for political reasons, and her father doesn't like it. He didn't seem, I mean, you know, he admitted, yes, the man was here legal, and if we had a stronger immigration system, she would not be alive today. So I don't think the purpose.
Well, he said we don't know.
We don't know.
Of course, we don't know. It's an imponderable. But you know, which type of system do you want? A system where we can say this could have been prevented, or a system where we know it won't be prevented? I mean, it's not a very difficult choice. Which again is why these stories, terrible as they are, are illustrative of terrible public policy, and this is a way to, I think, penetrate the consciousness of a lot of people who are otherwise generally unconscious about the importance of this issue and the potential implications of open borders. Yeah, he was room temperature. I mean, it's not like he was picking sides, but he was. So that's why I'm not getting into the used politically, and he's angry about it. Okay, fine, I appreciate that. And then, of course, the other side trying to seize on him saying used politically uses him politically. So, and the irony is lost on them. you know, I mean, this is just the nature of the D.C. press corps. They will take a word or a phrase and they will twist it into whatever they need it to mean in order to advance their flag. And if they'll do it with a grieving father as well.
I mean, the real bloodbath is we've had 23 Americans killed by illegals, either by murdering them with their bare hands, plummeting their skulls into the ground, or driving drunk and driving illegally, hitting somebody. I mean, the list, Elizabeth Medina, she was killed in her bathtub by an illegal. Melissa Reardon Powell, David Hadrich, Cindy Goulding, Cheston Edwards. The list goes on. I mean, it's 23 people. And well, sadly, and she's one of these 23 people.
And this is why you have to tell their stories. And you also maintain some level of proportionality. Compare and contrast this to the way that the left tells the stories of police-involved shootings or police-involved deaths of civilians. Because that's exactly what they do. Say your name, say their name, tell the story. And so we know the names of Laquan McDonald and George Floyd and many others. And then you have to remember the exact context. It's a little more complicated in the case of police and civilian, when oftentimes the civilians whose names we're supposed to say and stories we're supposed to remember were doing wrong. That's not the case here, obviously, with Lake and Riley and these other individuals who've been murdered by people in this country illegally. They were doing no wrong. So it's a little bit different. But the concept in terms of understanding an issue and getting people's attention and having people talk about it and maybe having some people that are otherwise not particularly good at processing information finally internalize what's happening around them. Mark on the South Side, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Good morning, Dan and Amy. Everybody knows President Trump's stance on this issue. Didn't his father himself make it a political issue by attending President Trump's rally and meeting with him backstage?
They're divorced.
Yeah, this is the ex. Well, this is right. Yeah. This is Lake and Riley's mom's ex-husband. I think it was the person she remarried and so forth. Regardless, I mean, and Lake and Riley's mom took out after President Biden after he confused her with a USC football coach. That's all fair game. You can say nothing. You can get involved as much as you want. Like I say, I think it's poor form to spend too much time getting into critiquing the reaction to grieving parents in the moment. So that's not the important point. The important point is, her life is the important point, and her life taken, as well as those many others, but also the underlying issue. So we don't have more Lake and Rileys, as Trump said over the weekend, in recommitting to a mass deportation operation if he were to be elected. There's something else going on, too, and we know this in Chicago and the outlying suburbs. We've seen it in Lake County. We've seen it in Oak Brook. What they're calling in L.A. tourist burglary gangs.
What?
They're tourists. This is very specific. I love the phrase. So now it's not exactly that we're going from newcomers to tourists. Now they're tourists. Because they're not tourists. The intent of the left is for them to stay permanently. There's no question. But there is this wrinkle that's being used in immigration law, according to this LAPD task force, that is providing a pathway for people into this country who are focused on robbing Americans.
We have a significant increase in burglaries from organized groups that are outside this country that are coming into the country, and they are targeting high-end residents, and we are addressing that specifically in a task force fashion through multi-agencies.
Lots of these break-ins have been recorded by security cameras in recent years. Detectives tell me many tourist burglars who've been arrested often entered the U.S. through a visa waiver program. Many were visiting from Chile and other South American countries. The LAPD says there have been more than 900 residential burglaries across the city since January, some of those committed by the tourist burglars who often target luxury homes in the foothills. And some of them may be using new technology technology to interfere with home security. Just last week, the LAPD's Wilshire station sent out this alert that Wi-Fi jammers had been used to block camera and alarm signals during some recent break-ins.
Some sort of device by burglars that actually deaden, kill, or stop Wi-Fi from operating.
The immediate fix for these home alarm systems is to hardwire them, where you plug those systems directly into your Ethernet in the wall and not use your Wi-Fi internally.
Choi says he's not sure if the tourist burglars have been using these devices, but the I-team has learned jammers and drones have been found by officers in Beverly Hills and other nearby cities. Last year, burglars were caught staking out homes in Orange County while wearing a camouflage suit like this, similar to ghillie suits worn by military snipers. And it's not just a California story. Police in Scottsdale, Arizona, announced today the arrests of a trio of suspected residential burglars, all in the U.S. on the visa waiver program and suspected of being part of a wide-ranging criminal organization.
These are Chilean burglary crews that are coming to the United States on the visa waiver program.
Sure.
Our new neighbors.
Venezuelans, Guatemalans, Chileans. It's not the country of origin or the ethnicity. It's the individuals. And we were hearing these stories about high-end foreign burglary rings hitting homes on the North Shore, I don't know, a couple of years ago. Obviously, the carjackings that have occurred on train lines, you know, anywhere where there's a train stop in the suburbs. Now, this is mostly Chicago coming out to the suburbs. It has been previously. But when you allow for an influx of millions of new people that you're not particularly good at or even interested in vetting, then and there's one wrinkle after another in terms of our immigration law and what kind of background checking is going on in the visa waiver program that the LAPD is referencing. I mean, it just is layers and layers of lawlessness.
900 homes in L.A. burglarized since January 2024. That's some work, man. That's a lot of work. But they were also doing that in suburban Detroit, too, where they jam your internet signal so that they can get into your house easily.
So if Brandon Johnson's Bring Home Chicago doesn't get you, then the tourist burglary rings. Or, I mean, that's just one. The visa waiver program is one. The other is just, you know, come on over, paroled, be flown in.
Yeah.
Through the parole system. Just get away coming across the border. There's so many ways the federal government and some state and local governments are facilitating foreign interlopers getting to you and your stuff. It's really something, isn't it?
I still can't get over to call them the tourists. Okay. They're touring your homes, yeah.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630, or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. Your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Day four of the bloodbath, ever since Trump's reference to the bloodbath, meaning if he is not elected and there is no one to stop China from setting up EV factories in Mexico and flooding the American market with EVs that undercut domestic manufacturers, that there'll be a bloodbath in the auto industry. And that's just the beginning of things, talking about it economically. As we talked about, and you've certainly heard about by now, but that does not stop the other side. And in point of fact, Biden's already up with a new spot on the bloodbath. And of doing in ad form what he did with what they've been doing rhetorically with the comparisons to Charlottesville. We'll get to that in a second. David Beschloss is this. Michael Beschloss. Michael Beschloss is this reputed presidential historian who is routinely on MSNBC. He was our 2022 winner for dumbest comment of the year.
Okay.
This was in advance of the 2022 elections, the midterm elections, where he said this.
A historian 50 years from now, if historians are allowed to write in this country, and if there are still free publishing houses and a free press, which I'm not certain of, but if that is true, a historian will say what was at stake tonight and this week was the fact whether we will be a democracy in the future, whether our children will be arrested and conceivably killed. We're on the edge of a brutal authoritarian system, and it could be a week away.
They're killing our children. I remember that. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. So now Michael Beschloss yesterday being prompted by Mika on that insufferable show. But just to give you a sense of where this is and where it will stay between now and November and potentially after if Trump is victorious. Here's the Mika setup.
Michael Beschloss, I want to ask you about Donald Trump increasingly sounding like a fascist, a dictator, mimicking them, and using words that are clearly out of the pages of some of the most powerful autocrats or dictators
Absolutely.
Of our time in
Absolutely.
The world.
Absolutely.
And I guess the fear is that for some Americans who may not be informed about history, there's that vulnerability that Trump preys upon. And then there are those who are making the choice. And I need to understand that. Is there any precedent? Or is this how fascism works? Are they sucked in and brought in on different terms, whether Trump has something on some Republican leaders or others are just so uninformed they don't care? Is it a mixture? How does it work? Is there a precedent?
Oh my God.
You ready for the answer in terms of Michael Beschloss trying to explain many of you listening who are enabling this rise of Trumpian fascism in America?
Well, I totally agree with what you've just said, Mika, and that's how fascism and totalitarianism and in Germany's case, the Holocaust came to Germany, which had been a country where there were big institutions of democracy until, as you well know, the early 1930s. In a way, Donald Trump has done us all a favor, because if you and I have been talking, Mika, let's say 20 years ago, and we had been talking about what would have seemed like a very abstract and distant subject of how fascism and dictatorship might come to America, you probably would have been more wiser. I would have said you would have had some smiling person pretending to be a normal candidate, like all the candidates for president who had gone before all the way back to 1789. And suddenly, after getting elected, that person would use the enormous powers of the presidency that are given to that person by the Constitution. In a way, Donald Trump has made it easier, because when he tells you he'll be a dictator for a day, we all know that dictators don't resign after a day. When he uses the word bloodbath, yes, it was in the context of an automobile industry speech, but he knew exactly what he was saying. When he talks about suspending the Constitution or migrants as animals,
You know, this is him. He's telling you what his choice is. So you were asking Mika, is there any precedent for this? No. I hate it when people treat this race as if it's just one more presidential campaign, you know, with lots of jokes, you know, both sides, you know, flaws in both candidates. Yes, these are two old candidates. One of them is mentally stable, Joe Biden, whom I saw give a great speech at the Gridiron dinner on Saturday night. Donald Trump, if you look at one of his speeches at these rallies, this is not someone who seems to have all of his marbles. So all I'm saying is apologize for the long answer, but it's important.
No.
As we talk about this campaign, as it unfolds, we have never seen anything remotely like this in American history. A major party candidate is saying, you elect me, there's going to be dictatorship, bloodbath, violence, retribution against my political enemies. That equals what we saw in Italy and Germany and other places. If Americans do not get that, if they choose that voluntarily, then this country has changed in a way that I do not understand.
312-642-5600, turnkey.pro, answer line 64636, type in DA, then a quick comment.
Yeah, it's important you hear the full Beschloss answer. I'd hate to take him out of context. And there it is. The Holocaust, dictatorship.
Inciting violence.
Vengeance. I mean, Trump explicitly says, you know, my revenge will be success, you know, the American people. But, I mean, that's the sort of stuff that you ignore. The other thing that very conveniently ignore is, you know, the last 8 years. Oh, they'll say, well, this comment in Charlottesville, which has been completely bastardized and distorted, you know, such that it does not even resemble remotely what he said. Comments here and comments there. How about his 4 years as president, where he was, other than rhetorically, a positively conventional president, as we have said many times before. He didn't do things like ignore a Supreme Court decision on student loan forgiveness. The courts enjoined him from doing some of the things he wanted to do. He had to deal with a Congress that was intractable on some of the things he wanted to do, including when Republicans were in charge and he wanted to get about building a more secure border fence. You know, so I just ask again, you know, so he had 4 years at the helm to establish this fascist dictatorship. So what went wrong? Is the D.C. press corps the hero in this story? Is that what stopped Donald Trump from becoming a dictator, suspending elections in perpetuity? I recall him leaving office on January 20th. You know, as is customary, if you lose your reelection, which you did.
Right.
Now, the surrounding litigation and the accusations, that's all well and good. And that's just the messiness of a free society. But this dictatorial gambit, why didn't it happen the first go around? And what specifically were the efforts that are indicative of, you know, the sort of comparisons that Michael Beschloss is making to Mussolini and the Third Reich? But I suppose this is what they think they can and must do, which is to buffalo a big enough percentage of the herd across the Fruited Plains into believing that this sort of Trumpian takeover of America is in the offing, and you'll be imprisoned, and the people you care about will be gulagged with, you know, and tortured and cast out, or whatever they think. All because somebody uses a word that is so ubiquitous in politics that if it was anybody else uttering it, it would have gone by without any notice.
Well, the left has uttered it. I mean, we're not going to play the whole thing, but listen.
But as Politico.com reports tonight on the, quote, bloodbath at the RNC, Headlines calling it a, quote, bloodbath.
Be a bloodbath. Not only is it going to be a bloodbath, but after they leave New Hampshire, it's a bloodbath on her home turf.
Yeah,
that's really tough. Trump has left a lot of corpses.
It goes on and on about there's a bloodbath with Biden and Bernie Sanders. You know, they're
completely prosaic.
Yep.
Language, like sports metaphors and war metaphors. But when Trump says it, you're supposed to read it as a code word that he's sending through some Rube Goldberg QAnon device to the masses to alert them that he just wait for my signal. And then the actual blood, it's going to be William Wallace running into the middle of a field. And Scott, I mean, it's just so beyond absurd. But this is where we are, beyond absurd.
Trump derangement syndrome is in full gear, folks.
Speaking of which, that Trump ad that I mentioned,
the
new Biden ad on Trump, and this is just a directly, so you distort what he said in Ohio, so you can compare it to distorting what he said in Charlottesville, and then you throw literally some Nazi imagery in there, and then you got a spot.
Now, if I don't get elected, it's going to be a bloodbath, and it's going to be a bloodbath for the country.
Jews will not replace us!
But you also had people that were very fine people on both sides.
Are you willing to condemn white supremacists and militia groups from
Proud Boys, stand back and stand by.
Please rise for the horribly and unfairly treated January 6th hostages.
There'd be a lot of pardons and commutations of January 6th defendants.
Yes, absolutely.
Tell your supporters now, no matter what, no violence.
And it's going to be a bloodbath.
Yeah, and you use background music from some Wes Craven film, and there you got your spot. Phil in Maryville, Indiana.
Hey, morning, guys. Throughout history, every dictator disarmed their citizens. The only one that wants to do that is Biden, whether he wants to take them or limit your firearms. Trump is fully on board with the Second Amendment and every citizen protecting themselves. And there's no way a dictator could do anything with a well-armed country. Thanks, guys.
Thanks, Phil. Joe in Hoffman Estates.
Hey, good morning. I do think Donald Trump, knowing that the press is going to take every single word that he says and pick it apart, should tone it down. Saying bloodbath is never going to work good. There's going to be sound bites with stuff like that. And on and on and on. When he gets in, he can do whatever he wants, and he does a great job. But wouldn't say bloodbath.
Okay, Joe.
Everything he says between now and the election is going to be overly scrutinized and overly taken out of context.
Yeah, or just be redefined into something he didn't say and clearly doesn't mean. The point is that when you're speaking extemporaneously at a rally, and you're going to like try and halt, thinking about what are they going to pick up on if I use this word or that word. I'm supposed to come up with a list of words I'm not allowed to say in the context of a political rally. No, that's not the way to do it. And it's not possible for him to avoid this sort of manufactured hysteria from the press corps. It's just not possible. Tone it down. First, and also, too, it's not possible for him to tone it down. That's not who he is. Right. So it's not going to happen. That's the one thing that will not happen. So the question is this going to be good enough for Biden to pull out a victory? And I don't think so. I don't think so, particularly as the pushback and the appropriate ridicule was instantaneous from sensible people. And it persists even as they run into day four and day five and day six. And I'm sure we'll see more ads. This will be referenced in the context of the next thing he says that they distort. So then they can have the distorted bloodbath comment, the distorted fine people comment from Charlottesville, and the next one. And so, yeah, you say it's building your case. But again, there's some lived experience here. Let's not forget that most of the American people that are not riveted to Morning Joe recall Trump's presidency. and what they're suggesting he is and what they've come to believe he is, the American people, are two different things. They might find him crude or vulgar or don't like his personality or don't like this policy and that. But, I mean, you have to go to some very sanitized, siloed places like the newsroom at MSNBC, propaganda room, probably a better description, or some wealthy white leftist enclave in a metropolitan area to get and be in rooms with people that have meaningless advanced degrees to get the sort of belief that they're going for with this line of argumentation in these spots. That's not what if that is not the weak underbelly of Trump's electoral prospects in November. The weak underbelly is if he gets convicted in Manhattan. But, well, that's a topic for another segment. Rich in Indian Head Park.
Good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy. What I wanted to say is the Democrats should never use the term misinformation because they misinform the people every day by twisting and lying about statements that are made that are truthful, and they turn them around to make them that they're not. And so that's why I think they should never use that term misinformation because they're the biggest offender of it. Thanks, and have a good day, guys.
Thanks for the call, Rich. And the other thing, too, is this is an opportunity to do a little jujitsu here and boomerang this on the left to remind people who they are, to Rich's point about the purveyors of misinformation. They're also the censorious set. And this is the point that Michael Schellenberger made on Jesse Waters' program yesterday.
I think what really concerns me, though, has been the involvement of the intelligence community. You know, we reported on and spoke to you a few weeks ago about the role of the CIA in creating the Russia collusion hoax to investigate falsely, to investigate and really impugn the Trump campaign. We start to see that with the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security. So it's really the marriage of those two things that really has me concerned, which is that they're going to start weaponizing the federal government against the American people as a way to, you know, try to engage in politics. But even more, you know, you see the victims of it, people being put away for really absurdly long times in jail and prison for participating in things like January 6th, far longer sentences than people are getting for violent crimes in places like California and New York.
So, Mike,
we saw what basically happened with the rise of the censorship industrial complex in reaction to Trump was the U.S. intelligence community using tools that they had used to wage psychological operations abroad, turning them against the American people in a counter-populist effort. Huge amounts of evidence at this point involved people at the Department of Homeland Security, British military, American military. So that's what worries me, is that this is all pretext of a larger campaign to essentially to turn Americans against each other and for Americans to start to see Trump supporters as a violent threat to democracy.
Well, there's no question that's what it is. Everybody who voted for Trump is an insurrectionist and is responsible in some material way for what happened on January 6th.
Yes.
That's been the basis for the last 3 years. But that other piece of it, too, and we've got this against the backdrop of the Supreme Court case, the Missouri versus Murthy case, oral arguments yesterday, the censorious nature of the left, the collusive arrangement between the federal government and social media, and I would say old media, too, in D.C., this is an opportunity to remind the American people of that unholy arrangement and what that portends for a free society. So I was glad to see Michael Schellenberger raise it. More should.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
Hey, business owners, is your business and money in good hands? Does your bank invest in your success? Hi, Mike Gallagher here, letting you know that when you need a relationship bank, Signature Bank makes commercial banking personal. I love these guys. Not only do they have expansive industry experience, a strong financial track record, but they're also highly capitalized for strategic growth. That's so important. That's why Signature Bank is my bank. They know what it means to grow a business by designing solutions that are right for you and only you. These are real people. They're ready to help. So reach out to my friends at Signature Bank. Make the call today, 773-467-5630. 773-467-5630. Or visit them online at signaturebank.bank. That's signaturebank.bank. your business could be Signature Bank's next success story. Go online, signaturebank.bank, member FDIC, equal housing lender. Signature Bank.
This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So, as you mentioned last hour, oral arguments in the Missouri v. Murthy case, this is a big one. This is the First Amendment case that deals with the federal government's collusion with social media platforms to suppress what they would call misinformation, what we might call dissent, dissenting viewpoints. So there were some really there was two, I think, critical exchanges yesterday in the Q&A, the oral arguments involving the representative parties, attorneys generals from some several states, as, and then on the one side, the federal government on the other side. Also, party to this case are our friends Martin Kulldorff and Jay Bhattacharya, since they were some of the targets of the federal government's direction to social media companies to suppress uncomfortable questions about COVID policies, the COVID response, in part. So let's start with Ketanji Brown Jackson. This is an exchange between KBJ, the smartest person on the high court, according to Joe Biden.
Right. Yeah, that's right. He made that declarative statement the other day.
Mm-hmm.
But you can't answer what a woman is.
Doesn't know what a woman is, but not she's still the smartest jurist on the bench, the high court.
Yeah, she is one, but she doesn't.
So the concern that she has with restraining the federal government from using social media, from treating social media companies as their subordinates, which is basically what they did if you read the reporting on the Twitter files done by Schellenberger and Taibbi and several other journalists that Elon Musk provided information to. So KBJ and the Attorney General of Louisiana.
Justice Jackson?
So my biggest concern is that your view has the First Amendment hamstringing the government in significant ways in the most important time periods. I mean, what would you have the government do? I've heard you say a couple times that the government can post its own speech, but in my hypothetical, kids, this is not safe, don't do it. Is not going to get it done. And so I guess some might say that the government actually has a duty to take steps to protect the citizens of this country. And you seem to be suggesting that that duty cannot manifest itself in the government encouraging or even pressuring platforms to take down harmful information. So can you help me? Because I'm really worried about that. Because you've got the First Amendment operating in an environment of threatening circumstances from the government's perspective, and you're saying that the government can't interact with the source of those problems.
And, Your Honor, I understand that instinct, and I guess what I tell you is our position is not that the government can't interact with the platforms there. They can and they should in certain circumstances like that present such dangerous issues for society and especially young people. But the way they do that has to be in compliance with the First Amendment. And I think that means they can give them all the true information that the platform needs and ask to amplify that.
Right, but you're just saying that. I guess I thought when you say the way they do that is consistent with the First Amendment is that they have to show that they have a compelling interest to do what they're doing. In other words, you want us to take the line to be between compulsion and encouragement. And what we're looking at is the government can't compel, maybe they can encourage. I'm wondering whether that's not really the line. The line is, does the government, pursuant to the First Amendment, have a compelling interest in doing things that result in restricting the speech in this way? That test, I think, takes into account all of these different circumstances, that we don't really care as much about how much the government is compelling, or maybe we do, but in the context of tailoring and not as sort of a freestanding inquiry that's overlaid on all of this. Does that make sense?
It does, Your Honor, and I apologize for missing your guidance earlier. So the way I think about that is I've been discussing the standard, and I thought we've all been discussing the standard on the front end of the analysis, which is there a First Amendment violation? Is there an infringement of speech? I guess I would conceptually think of strict scrutiny, narrow tailing, compelling interest as coming in at the back end to say, yes, maybe in the ordinary case, the government shouldn't have been permitted to undertake the kind of suppression of free speech that it did. But in this unique circumstance, it actually had a compelling interest, and it used narrowly tailored means to accomplish that interest. I mean, I think that's the fail-safe. If you're concerned with the breadth of our arguments, that's one fail-safe, which is no matter how broad the standard the court adopts, there's always going to be strict scrutiny at the end of the line to save the government in times where it desperately needs to do the things that you're outlining.
Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Oh, thank you. By the way, that was the Louisiana Solicitor General you heard, not the AG. I misidentified him, Benjamin Aguinaga. So do you see what they're getting at there, the two of them? 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. The argument that they're having and KBJ's curious statement about that you heard her open with in her inquiry, the First Amendment hamstringing the federal government. So that's the point of the First Amendment, by the way, and the entirety of the Bill of Rights is the restraints on the government. You call it hamstringing. I call it restraining. That's the point. And what she's trying to do is provide a basis on the front end for the government to have sort of this open-ended fail-safe from those restraints by saying, well, this is a compelling state interest. And what he's saying, the Louisiana Solicitor General, appropriately so, is, wait, what are you talking about? I mean, he says it politely because he has to, but we have the compelling state interest and narrowly tailored the strict scrutiny analysis, the standard of analysis, and the compelling state interest exception and narrowly tailored in service of the compelling state interest. If you can substantiate that after the fact, you don't get open. I mean, what I would have said just in terms of making it really clear in principle, you're talking about open-ended. She's clearly talking about open-ended power for the federal government to just invoke compelling state interests and eviscerate the First Amendment. And the other thing, too, I might have pointed out, and I confess I didn't hear all of the oral arguments, so maybe this was pointed out by this Louisiana Solicitor General or someone else. But, you know, it's interesting you bring that up. So if the federal government, Justice KBJ, if the federal government thought what they were doing was well within their rights under the First Amendment because of this compelling state interest that would survive strict scrutiny, then here's a question. Why didn't they do it out in public? Why didn't they do it open and notoriously? Why do you have various bureaucrats from various intel, law enforcement, public health agencies all surreptitiously through private communication channels pressuring, chiding, browbeating employees at Twitter and Facebook to do their bidding? Why wouldn't you do that in public if it's so obvious and if it's so righteous? That was one important exchange. The other was between Samuel Alito and Brian Fletcher, who's the deputy Solicitor General for the federal government for the United States. And this was on the nature of the relationship between the federal government and the social media companies, as well as old media. Alito drew a distinction that I don't think exists anymore, but it was interesting to hear his perception as opposed to, I think, the reality that maybe we know a little bit better out here in the hinterlands. Very interesting exchange that points to something that we've talked about through the entirety of the Twitter file saga, which is the federal government cannot outsource to a private entity the job of doing something that it cannot do directly.
Well, they were so close. Remember, they considered each other coworkers. One of those emails that was released, you know, because they worked so closely together.
Yes, and the
all
FBI
the time
was
is censoring, you know, social media posts.
And the FBI is paying for overtime for Twitter employees. Yeah. And I mean, that's pretty close. All right, here's Alito and Fletcher.
Exchange between the White House and other federal officials and Facebook in particular, but also some of the other platforms. And I see that the White House and federal officials are repeatedly saying that Facebook and the federal government should be partners. We're on the same team. Officials are demanding answers. I want an answer. I want it right away. When they're unhappy, they curse them out. There are regular meetings. There is constant pestering of Facebook and some of the other platforms, and they want to have regular meetings. And they suggest, why don't you, they suggest rules that should be applied, and why don't you tell us everything that you're going to do so we can help you and we can look it over. And I thought, wow, I cannot imagine federal officials taking that approach to the print media, our representatives over there. If you did that to them, what do you think the reaction would be? And so I thought, you know, the only reason why this is taking place is because the federal government has got Section 230 and antitrust in its pocket, and it's, to mix my metaphors, and it's got these big clubs available to it. And so it's treating Facebook and these other platforms like their subordinates. Would you do that to the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Associated Press or any other big newspaper or wire service?
So there's a lot packed in there. I want to give you one very specific answer first and then step back out to the broader context. So specifically, you mentioned demanding an answer right away and cursing them out. The only time that happens is in an email that's about the president's own Instagram account. It's not about moderating other people's
content. Okay, we'll put that aside. There's all the rest. So, constant meetings, constant emails. We want answers. Right. We're partners. We're on the same team. Do you think that the print media regards themselves as being on the same team as the federal government, partners with the federal government?
So potentially in the context of an effort to get Americans vaccinated during a once-in-a-lifetime pandemic. And I really think that piece of context, it doesn't change the First Amendment principles, but it's relevant to how they apply here. And I think it's important to understand that at this time, this was a time when thousands of Americans were still dying every week, and there was a hope that getting everyone vaccinated could stop the pandemic. And there was a concern that Americans were getting their news about the vaccine from these platforms, and the platforms were promoting, not just posting,
well,
but promoting bad information.
I understand all that, and I know the objectives were good. But once again, they were also getting their news from the print media and the broadcast media and cable media, and I just can't imagine the federal government doing that to them. But maybe I'm naive. Maybe that goes on behind the scenes. I don't know, but it struck me as, wow, this is not what I understand the relationship to be. That's all.
I think this is important because I have the same reaction that you do, that these emails look unusual. I think the idea that there'd be back and forth between the government and the media isn't unusual at all. When the White House press secretary on July 16th is asked about this by the press at the time, what she says is, of course we talk to the platforms just the way we talk to all of you when we have concerns about what you're doing, when we have information that you might find helpful. Now, there's an intensity of the back and forth here, and there's an anger that I think is unusual, but the context for that, I think, is that these platforms were saying publicly, we want to help. We think we have a responsibility to give people accurate information and not bad information. And we're doing everything we can to meet that goal. That's where this language of partnership comes from. It's not just from the White House. It's these platforms, which are powerful, sophisticated entities, saying we're doing the best we can. And the anger, I think really most of the anger when you read the emails, and I appreciate that you have, because I think you have to look at them in context. The anger is when the officials think that the platforms are not being transparent about the scope of the problem, or aren't giving information that's available.
The platforms aren't being transparent. Oh, that's rich. Oh, boy. So here's the bottom line, if I could bottom line that for you. It was okay to abridge people's First Amendment rights through using a cutout in the social media companies because they were saving lives during COVID. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line. 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line. You want to hear an argument for autocracy. You just heard it from KBJ and from Solicitor General Brian Fletcher. For all this talk about the end of our liberties under Trump and so on and so forth. I mean, good grief. You know, meanwhile, back at the ranch, you have these new Marxists coming up with flowery, altruistic sounding rationales to end people's free speech rights, to quell dissent. And by the way, just a point of order, you know, it turns out that this great partnership between the tech moguls and the federal government resulted in the propagation of, dare I say, misinformation. I mentioned at the outset, Bhattacharya and Kulderoff are parties to this case. Yeah, because they were largely right about the missteps the federal government was making in real time. And to have the position of KBJ or Solicitor General Brian Fletcher win the day is to say we silence or do our best to best attempt to silence, as was done, those who have expert knowledge but aren't going along with the officially agreed to state position.
Right. I mean, she's supposed to interpret the law based on the Constitution, not give her own feelings and opinions.
Ralph and Rantoul, you're on Chicago's Morning Answer.
Yeah, good morning. I'm almost done reading Walter Isaacson's biography of Elon Musk, and in it there's the very interesting treatment of the whole Twitter thing with Musk buying it. What is apparent through all of that, if just ignoring the Elon Musk narrative and all that storyline, these guys are already in bed with the feds because most of the people running these tech platforms are leftists. And the fear, you know, I guess if the government succeeds, or if these stooges succeed in convincing the Supreme Court that, of course, the government looking out for our best interests is going to allow this or even codify it by making it legally permissible to cooperate like that and to control it, we're screwed, because all of these platforms are going to become apparatus of the intelligence agencies forever. And that's part of the whole furor over TikTok. These social platforms are very, very effective at convincing and moving weak minds to believe and do what they want, especially when it comes to voting. All of the suppression of the stories, the hidden algorithms, the use of censorship by AI and all of the technology behind the scenes, people don't get it. They're already being manipulated and stooged up by all this stuff. If we can't separate this and make it illegal for this cooperation, we're going to have a really misinformed populace as the official position.
No question. Thanks for the call, Ralph. I mean, we're going to be back to Cato's letters passing pamphlets around the town square while misinformation with the state's officially licensed propaganda moves at the speed of the internet. Right. That's exactly it. I mean, it's really something. By the way, it's also interesting. I mean, Sam Alito needs to get up to speed a little bit. When he said maybe I'm being a little naive, Justice Alito, you are being a little naive if you think the D.C. press corps is not in partnership with the state, that this is not big government media, not just in D.C., but in all the urban outposts around the country, too. So perhaps this is, I mean, I think that the Supreme Court is not going to go along with the state's argument here, thanks to the composition of the court. But this sounds like there's a little bit even more of an awakening going on for people like Alito, just in terms of how embedded the supposed fourth estate is with the actual state, that it does not serve as a bulwark against the state anymore. It serves as its comm shop. That's something that Alito clearly doesn't understand, and maybe it's starting to come into focus for him. Frank in Lamont.
Hey, Dan. Hey, Amy. You know, I cringed when I heard her say the First Amendment was an impediment to the federal government, because, Dan, they're attacking the Second Amendment. What's next, the Fourth? The one where we have a right to not be illegally searched? How about the Fifth? to not incriminate myself? Or how about my right to an attorney? Which one's next, Dan? Which is the next one to impede the federal government?
Right. You don't want to hamstring the federal government. That's the worst thing you can do.
Yeah, we don't want to, you know, with some nonsense like needing an attorney or the right to a speedy trial. It's insane. Thank you.
Thanks, Frank. Joe, Arlington Heights.
What was missing from the conversation is, after the fact, what if we find out the government was wrong, how much damage was done? I posted something on LinkedIn about the Great Barrington Declaration and an article about the Wuhan lab very early in the process. And they took those down. Those are, guess what? Both those things turned out to be true.
Yep.
Of course they did, which is why, and maybe KBJ and others would like to be reminded why Brandeis said that the cure for speech you don't like, I'm paraphrasing, is more speech. Why Robert Jackson said in West Virginia versus Barnett that compulsory unification of opinion achieves only the unanimity of the graveyard. They're treading on some real fine lines here, at least those justices who are sympathetic to this government arrangement with media companies to do its bidding illegally, unconstitutionally.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. Only the biggest stories, only the biggest guests, and only the biggest opinions. This is AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. Oh, yeah, it's Election Day.
Yeah.
One of the more interesting ballot questions is not even between two candidates, at least in Chicagoland and the city of Chicago in particular. It's, of course, the Bring Home Chicago referendum that's been placed on the ballot by BLM Brandon. It would change the real estate transfer tax rates for people selling homes for more than $1 million versus those selling homes for less than $1 million. So properties under $1 million currently account for about 95% of all sales, home sales in Chicago. They will see a decrease in the real estate transaction tax owed. It'll go down from 0.75% to 0.60%, which is a 20% cut. Sales over $1 million will pay a 2% rate on the portion that of the sale that's over $1 million, which is more than 2.5 times what they pay now. And then if you go $1.5 million more than $1.5 million, you'll pay 3% on the portion that's over $1.5 million, which is about 4 times the current rate. Simple majority approves it, and then we soak these rich ne'er-do-wells with their million and multi-million dollar mansions so that we can solve the homeless problem and provide adequate housing for the estimated 68,000 homeless people in Chicago. That's the promise. Anybody believe that?
I mean, what a bunch of bog. And then the CPS or CTU says, no, but part of that, too, has got to house homeless or help house Chicago public school teachers who can't afford to live in the city. Please.
So we're building Chicago public school teacher housing, too.
Right. And then they say it's to house the homeless. Well, guess who's homeless? People who are here illegally. And on Friday, kids left school by the hundreds. And CTU kept saying, oh, no, we're not telling them how to vote. Oh, really? Thank you, Craig Wall from Channel 7.
They help with, like, the homelessness in on the streets and stuff and make housing more affordable.
Did your teachers encourage you to vote for it?
Yes.
Okay.
Well, of course they did. They're chanting. They're chanting these slogans of the left as they're taking the kids on their march to the polling place. But real subtle. But here's, and if you don't like it, Oh, you got a problem with it?
Every vote matters.
It was billed as a nonpartisan parade to the poll.
We are asking you to give us an opportunity to tell our story. It will cost $50 billion and 3 cents. Where's the Civic Federation Committee? Where y'all at? Where y'all table? Yes, it will. And so what? That's audacity.
That is audacity. The Stacey Davis Gates at the City Club a couple weeks ago talking about the next teacher contract and making light of it. It'll cost $50 billion because who cares? Whatever amount of money we want,
we'll
that's
get
what we're going to get. And so what?
Yeah.
So what Bring if we it. Take the kids to school to the from school to the polling place and we're feeding them the same bilge on the way to the polling place that we feed them in the classroom? So what's the difference? So what? So what's your problem? So what? So what if we want to crater the housing market in Chicago? Certainly the housing market over $1 million, which, you know, not as much as it used to be in the Biden era. But anyway, I digress. The point is, so what? So what? What do you have to say about it? And to listen to some of these Democrat apparatchiks like Greg Goldner, you know, all these Madigan flacks from a bygone era, bringing their hands about this. Oh, I'm part of the coalition to do this and do that. And all these goo-goo, cake-eating, left-leaning corporate hacks at the Civic Federation or the Economic Club or the Realtors Association. Oh, blah, blah, blah. So what? So you don't like it? Well, Mrs. Audacious is in charge. So what about your opinion? And that's what's going to happen today, by the way.
You think it's going to pass?
100%.
Okay. I was going to vote for it because I wanted to screw my liberal neighbors, but now I'm voting against it. And I'm going to have
because
a Democratic ballot.
Because you don't want to
screw yourself? Because I don't want to be part of watching Rome burn. It doesn't affect me. My house isn't worth $1 million.
Yeah. Well, it's certainly not going to be if you don't sell it soon. Maybe a couple of years ago.
It was worth $210,000 more than it is worth now.
Who is telling you?
You and Sean, and don't start with me, please.
Yeah. No. Well, all right.
Okay.
All right. For more on this and other Econ 101 case studies, we're pleased to be joined by Jim Urio. Host of the Futures Edge podcast, owner of Brants and Palatine. Well, I think I've also told Jim to sell Brants and Palatine, sell his compound in Palatine, get the hell out of here, too. But anyway, Jim, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thank you for having me. Some other things you talked about just kept bringing up one thing in my head. For, you know, studying economics since college and then having that might be my career, there was always the concept of unintended consequences of stupid economic policies. Every vector is pointing to the destructive, toxic direction. You have to start thinking it's not unintended anymore. So what will happen if they pass this thing about the $1 million transfer tax? Money goes to where it's treated best. A state should be welcoming with open arms wealthy people. The second you start to look at them like they're the criminals, you push them away, and you're already pushing them away. So this just accelerates the demise of our state. The whole thing is asinine.
And what's next will be the city income tax, or the, you know, because you have to fill federal, state, and then city tax will be next.
Well, we need to build that. This is $100 million, which, by the way, just to give you sort of some proportion here, this what's the name of this Lincoln Park homeless shelter?
Oh,
outfit?
Next to the Episcopal Church.
Care for Friends.
Yes.
Care for Friends. They just broke ground on a $9 million. Essentially homeless shelter for the unhoused, facility for the unhoused, whatever you want to call it. My understanding is it doesn't have living quarters. It provides like health care and food and so on and so forth. And that's all fine, but $9 million. And Brandon Johnson is going to take another shot, wants to, if the voters probably join him, and they probably will, take another shot at the real estate market in Chicago, because, by the way, this also applies to commercial, not just residential.
Right, business owners.
So he's going to take another shot. I mean, for $100 million that he thinks is going to house 68,000 people, the whole thing is completely fiction. It's completely fictional.
Hey, but you know what? So what? Just like you were.
Yeah, so what?
What? Yeah. So the tents are still going to be up. I mean, the homeless people, not all of them want to be housed. I'm blue in the face, and people don't really spend time at a homeless shelter to meet these people. I did for a year. I met them. I was with them every Tuesday night for Tuesday night supper. They don't want to be housed.
It doesn't matter. The government will give them what they want to give them. Here's the thing that amazed me, because the homeless shelter, and that obviously that topic leads in with the migrant. I love it when they call it the migrant crisis, the crisis that they could stop at any moment, the crisis that the media and the government has pushed on us for the last however many years. But they call it this crisis, and it's breaking apart, it seems, their voter base, but they don't care. The hubris to me is amazing. It's almost like they don't have a care in the world about them being out of office. And that's when you break down, and you did it eloquently, that's so what. What she means is, so what? We have everything in place to remain powerful in this state, and it's way beyond your petty little pointing fingers at us and saying we're doing it wrong. So what? So the whole thing is unbelievable to me.
Yeah, that's exactly what it is. That's exactly the message that she's communicating.
Yep.
All right, let's scale this to national and international economics. You heard maybe in Mike Scott's newscast that the Japan Central Bank is going to increase rates for the first time in 17 years. Is that any sort of canary in the coal mine about global inflation?
No, I don't think so. You know, Japan, we looked at Japan for a long time, and they had a deflationary spiral for 30 years. So they used the opportunity of a locked-up supply chain to throw a ton of money in the system to try to get themselves inflation. And they were successful at it, not great, but they got themselves some inflation. But the point of this move today to take rates from negative to positive, the market, the Japanese yen is still weaker on the day, just today, meaning the market doesn't believe that Japan is really going to start yanking rates up really high. What mm-hmm. they're going to do is one off and take a look. China, they think, is on the precipice of great decline, so they really can't raise rates too high. So I don't think it's an enormous deal, and that's what the market's saying as well. What is an absolutely huge deal is in this country that every economist that's on the left keeps talking about the fact that we have a good economy but never mentions the $34.5 trillion elephant in the room, which is the fact that government keeps spending money to keep everything afloat and papering over any holes in the wall. And that, to me, is unforgivable.
Well, we can decry the modern monetary theorists all we want, but they're winning the day. So until it becomes clear that, I would think that people having to have 20% more today in take-home pay than they did 3 years ago just to keep pace, and very few people do, I would think that would bring this to a head in terms of what these people are doing doesn't make sense and it's hurting me. But I'm not so sure people are exactly learning the lesson.
Well, this is very interesting you bring that up, because normally in election cycles, inflation is something that the incumbents would worry about. They're not worried about it right now. They're actively spurring inflation. Inflation has picked back up again, and that is not any mystery at all as to why that's happening. That's the government spending that we just talked about. So it must be some strategy to try to somehow blame it on the right, or blame it on, you know, local shopkeepers with price gouging or whatever they call it. What do they call it? Corporate greed. And that's
yes.
a terrible
mm-hmm.
thing. Corporate mm-hmm. greed. I love that. Corporate greed is what kept us from living in caves. I like greed in all its forms.
To your point, not to interrupt, but to your point, that's exactly what they're doing. Biden today in Nevada is going to talk about targeting landlords that are keeping rents artificially high. They're gouging their tenants.
So, and we know the one thing that is 100% agreed upon is anytime the government comes in and tries to price fix anything, they, in the medium term and long term, make the prices go higher. And like, we can start with rent control, like you're saying, because that's a cousin of rent control, of course. Every time, even when a government starts talking about rent control, the big developers start moving out of an area. We've seen that every time. Every time it's been instituted, the same thing happens, and prices go through the roof because the government came in to keep prices down. And what they end up doing is choking supply and not bringing new participants to the market. So this is not something that's settled science within the economic community, that the things he's doing is making prices go higher. What he thinks is that there is a majority of people who are too ignorant to know that that's what it is, and things that sound good. Thomas Sowell, my favorite economist ever, always said that if you characterize the last 50 years, it's policies that worked being replaced with policies that sound good. And that's another one. Yeah, oh, we're going to keep rents down? Sounds great. No, that's not what happens with this.
But back to the larger point then, so $34.5 trillion in debt, it sounds like a problem, but it's not being treated like one. And look at the markets, and look at the cryptos, and then also my president tells me that inflation is coming down, and unemployment is low, and job creation is happening, and they're making big investments in this transformative green economy. And what's the big problem? As soon as Jay Powell cuts rates, it's going to be another boomlet.
It's it just I'm shaking my head because when you talk about, you mentioned the MMTers, the modern monetary theory people, and you know, a currency crisis, if, and I'm not saying we're going to get to a currency crisis, I am saying we're headed in that direction at an unacceptable pace. But a currency crisis is the absolute worst type of any financial crisis. Like the last time it happened in Venezuela, in Caracas, the feral cat and rat population disappeared because they became a food source to people once you create a crisis for your currency.
Hey, so they're on spits in New York City right now. The rats are. We've seen that with the Venezuelans who've come. They've brought their delicacies with them.
Wow, that's fantastic. See, that, again, all we can do is shake our head because the risk that they're running with our currency to me is unbelievable. We have it all here. We have, you know, we're America. We have the greatest economic engine that's ever been created. And for them to be rolling the dice with some moronic theory, modern monetary theory, which, by the way, modern monetary theory will always fail. It basically is they can keep spending money as much as they want. And the second they find inflation, they raise taxes real quick to drag money out of the liquidity out of the system. There's two problems with that. One, they couldn't see inflation. If it jumped out of the bushes and slapped them in the face, it was there. Over our lifetime, it's been there in tech stocks, there in real estate. It was even there in the traditional method in the summer of 2021. They ignored it, called it transitory, and just hit the gas with accommodation, making the inflation much, much worse. So they can't find inflation. They won't be able to raise taxes in the middle of a business cycle just on the fly. If we ever gave them that power anyway, we'd live to regret it. So the whole thing is a moronic, absolutely moronic theory that always will fail.
Jim Urio, host of the Futures Edge podcast, proprietor of Brants and Palatine. Jim, thanks as always.
Thank you, guys. See you. Have a good day.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer.
That's on me. It's time for in-depth history with Frank, the history teacher from Arlington Heights, because there's nothing new in this world. It's just the history we don't know. Frank, take it away.
Good morning. The guy is a total monster. He's a sociopathic, psychopathic, malignant narcissist. No imitation, but Robert De Niro describing Donald Trump on Bill Maurer's show recently. Pretty tough words, but way off the mark. Study the 20th century to find some real monsters, Bobby. Another suggested area of study, though, for Mr. De Niro would be the Law of 22 Prairial, passed by the French Jacobins on June 10, 1794, or 22 Prairial on their calendar. This law stripped all enemies of the revolution of their individual rights of self-defense in a trial. Rings a bell in our time, doesn't it? Some January 6 defendants still languish in a D.C. jail. No speedy trial for them. And our Justice Department engages in obviously selective prosecution and retention of classified documents. In New York State, Trump faces an obscene civil court jury award, and his business faces extinction there because it used standard financial leveraging practices. And then Trump attorney John Eastman also faces disbarment for advocating on behalf of his client regarding possible legal ways to challenge the 2020 election. But back to De Niro, I wonder what his character in Cape Fear, Max Cady, no angel, would say about the Eastman case. Perhaps it would probably be something like his recitation of the ABA's Rules of Professional Conduct, Canon 7, during the boat scene at the end.
A lawyer should zealously represent his client within the bounds of the law.
Cady was right, and Eastman is being persecuted. But why all this lawfare, our post-postmodern version of 22 Prairial? I'd say Gregory Peck's character in Cape Fear says it right. Moral turpitude.
I thought maybe the Gregory Peck reference was going to be an Atticus Finch one. But, okay. All right. Very good. Very good, Frank. The De Niro impersonation.
Yeah. What did you think?
Oh, I need some work on that one. No doubt about it.
Yeah.
A little bit.
Yeah. I mean, I know you're sort of our resident Rich Little, but yeah, it does need a little bit. A little bit of a touch up, but very good.
We appreciate you, yes.
And great reference to the French Revolution. There's our little history.
It's news, opinion, insight. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560. The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560. The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. So last week, we brought you this instructional from Loyola Academy there in Tony Wilmette. Loyola Academy, private Catholic school, anybody in Chicagoland knows, in a wealthy honky enclave where the schools, even the ostensibly Catholic ones, are self-flagellation spas to release guilt toxins. And,
wow.
And that's what Loyola Academy is.
Okay.
So this wheel of power and privilege. This we didn't know this at the time, but it turns out this was offered in a theology class. And it's concentric circles that, you know, the outer ring is marginalized and then you close into the center ring, which is power. And it's all the typical identitarian nonsense. Marginalized, you know, you're marginalized based on or powerful based on where you fall in these categories: citizenship, skin color, ability, sexuality, neurodiversity, body size, housing, wealth, language, gender.
Yeah, it's a pinwheel, and you tweeted it out. So
right,
if you guys want to see it? Go to Dan Proft.
Yeah, at Dan Proft on Twitter. So yeah, spin the wheel and pick a victim status. For example, gender, trans on the marginalized, from marginalized to powerful, trans, non-binary, cisgender woman, cisgender man. Hmm. Yeah. Don't tell Rachel Levine that, or Dylan Mulvaney. Skin color, marginalized, dark, to different shades to white. White is powerful. And dark is by definition marginalized. Everything is by definition. Power and marginalized. It's the same thing as saying oppressor and oppressed. They're just sanitizing it a bit. And you can figure out the rest. Body size. Large. Yeah, big people don't have any power in this country. You know, except our governor. Large to slim. Marginalized to power. Mm-hmm. So tweeted this out. We talked about it, tweeted this out. People picked it up. Some parents that didn't know at Loyola got wind of it. And apparently there was enough attention drawn to this that the president of the high school and the principal and the vice president of mission, ministry, and identity issued this letter to parents. We want to communicate clearly and transparently to you, the parents of Loyola Academy students in a sophomore theology class, Christian life and community, about a recent lesson. The lesson was about justice as an expression of Christian faith and was anchored by the Beatitudes and the parable of the Good Samaritan in the Gospel of Luke. It explored how Jesus embraced the dignity of those on the periphery of society. The emphasis was on the inclusivity of the kingdom of God through the Catholic Church's see, judge, act process for moral discernment, as explained by, among others, Pope St. John the 23rd in his 1961 encyclical, Mater Dei Magistra. Understanding the idea of periphery was central to this lesson, as it is central to the understanding of life and the work of Jesus, and to living our Jesuit charism to form leaders in service as women and men for others. Boy, they're really laying it on. To illustrate the idea of periphery, a visual of a wheel was displayed that contained the words power and privilege. Since the language of this visual has drawn focus away from the lesson objectives and the values being taught, we will no longer use this visual.
Oh, there you go.
Small victories. 312-642-5600, turnkey.pro answer line, 64636-DA, turnkey.pro text line.
So they didn't remove it because it was the right thing to do. They removed it because they got caught doing it.
It drew focus away from the objectives.
Too.
So they're not admitting that they're... liberation theology, you know, the modern day incarnation being social justice Catholicism, is wrongheaded and antithetical to the catechism, this identity obsession. They're not admitting that. They're conceding the visual because it's just too obviously an affront to those like me who understand what they're doing. And like a lot of parents at Loyola, apparently, because this is not, they're not doing so willingly. They're doing so under pressure, of course. When does the left do anything willingly, particularly in the area of admitting something they're saying or doing or advocating is wrong? And then this, too, boy, these Reverend, the good Reverend Gregory Ostick, the president of Loyola, Tim Devine, an 88 grad who's the principal, Allison Kearney Alwyn, the vice president of Mission, Ministry, and Identity. I mean, really, honestly, you all should be ashamed of yourselves. You're a disgrace. And so is that school. Why don't you, instead of, what's Loyola Academy's nickname? The Ramblers? Oh, no, that's Loyola University. The Wildcats? Oh, no, that's not. What's the nickname? Well, maybe it is the Ramblers. Anyway, they should change it to the Poltroons, because these people are cowards. And they're just absolute cowards. And then this is really the coup de grace for me. They reference that encyclical from Pope St. John the 23rd again, and this passage from that encyclical. Differences of opinion in the application of principles can sometimes arise even among sincere Catholics. When this happens, they should be careful not to lose their respect and esteem for each other. Instead, they should strive to find points of agreement for effective and suitable action and not wear themselves out in interminable arguments and under pretext of the better or the best, omit to do the good that is possible and therefore obligatory. Right. Don't make the perfect the enemy of the good. This isn't good. And the intentions aren't good. And I have no respect for any of these people. And you shouldn't either. And this is a fundamental philosophical, theological, if you want, worldview conflict. And there's no, like, let's just focus on points of agreement. It is fundamental disagreement about the faith, and even in a secular sense, about the way society should be organized. This identitarian business is poison. Intellectual and civilizational poison. It doesn't belong in schools. It doesn't belong in corporate America. It doesn't belong anywhere. Not if you want to have a free, peaceful, pluralistic society. So you can say that we share the same goal, but you can't say that this poison gets us to that place, because it doesn't. And we're seeing manifestations of it over and over again. And it's not because of, you know, white cisgender honkies like me are hanging on to our power. It has nothing to do with it. And just the fact that that's their fallback position speaks to the intentional divisiveness of this ideology that's all about just changing the identity of the power structure in society. So no, there's no like, oh, let's just all agree to disagree. No, absolutely not. And, Loyola Academy and the leadership of that school cannot take enough heat. That just because they're removing this instructional, you haven't won anything, because they are not chastened at all.
Well, what about the teacher who pushed this through? What about removing them?
Well, why would you remove the teacher when the principal and the vice president and the president don't see anything wrong with it?
Yeah, that's true.
Christine Rogers Park.
I believe the teacher in that class is named Patrick Brown, and I believe he came from School of St. Mary in Lake Forest, where he was principal, and there was not one black teacher. And to the best of my knowledge, they just hired a black teacher, their first one, this fall. And there's some other issues going on there with race, too.
All right. Thanks for the call, Christine. Patrick Brown is the name I've heard. I couldn't confirm that this was his class, but it's the name I've heard. But, I mean, of course. I mean, if I had a guess, I would guess that this is some, you know, guilt-ridden, weak-minded leftist honky from a wealthy enclave, same areas in Lake Forest. No surprise. I know there are political activists and CPS and some of the schools in the city that where there's more racial diversity in the teaching corps. But I mean, for people that are actually living in the real world, you think they have time for this? This is exactly what the identitarians are counting on. People don't have the time or the mind share to devote to this, and they don't want to. That's the point. They don't want to. You have to force feed it through the to them in school and in DEI sessions at your workplace. This is not natural, and people instinctively know this is counterproductive. Andy in Dallas, Texas.
Just the height of lazy thinking, and the red flag is when they come up with a word salad explanation. And the other red flag is when they're credentialed up the wazoo. Like you said, these people don't live in the real world. They love to paint targets on the back of what they call the not privileged, and they make people targets their entire life by painting those targets on their back. It's maddening.
It is maddening because they're by the way, bastardizing the faith is maddening too. I mean, I learned the Beatitudes and the corporal and spiritual works of mercy and the catechism, you know, the entirety of it in grade school and into high school. And we didn't, I never got this race identity stuff because it wasn't around when I was matriculating through Catholic schools, K through 12. But it was obviously about being a servant leader. That hasn't changed. And it was about being your brother's keeper. And it was about the golden rule, all the simple things that sort of have, you know, ecumenical appeal now and are really shared values. Clothing the naked and feeding the poor and sheltering the homeless and all those things. Yes, right, right. And so it was never the black homeless versus the white homeless.
Right, it was just the homeless.
And then you have living examples of this too. Bob Woodson at the Woodson Center, a frequent guest here. You know, he spent the last 65 years of his life trying to uplift and provide opportunity to poor people in America. Not poor black people versus white people versus Latino people, just poor people, disadvantaged people. But that's not the curriculum at Loyola Academy, because that's not the attitude of the leadership of that school, and I'm sure most of the faculty. I can't imagine there's a huge disconnect between the leadership and the faculty, because leadership usually surrounds itself with the like-minded. And obviously Loyola Academy is just a wonderful illustration, but it's not isolated. The guy came from St. Mary's in Lake Forest, the teacher, alleged teacher, wouldn't surprise me. And this is everywhere, everywhere. Will in Kane County.
Hey, Dan, Amy, how you guys doing? Listen to you every day. Big fan. Just a brief comment. Just the color of skin is so irrelevant. It's nauseating. I think people need to just have just an understanding and a respect for, regardless of color, we're all human. We all bleed red. It just absolutely nauseates me that we are compartmentalized into these sectors where you have judges that are incompetent, people of color. I'm not going to mention any names. I do watch the news. I don't understand why or how some of these judges, lawyers, or whatever get into their positions. There's just ignorant, emotional, lack of objective rule of law is just absolutely nauseating to me.
Thanks for the call, Will. Tim Devine is the principal. He uses the term Latinx in his bio to refer to Latinx, to refer to Latino students. He's also a former CPS teacher.
Of course.
Yeah. Latinx. Right. So even a moniker that Latino students don't like, you know, like by 98%, most have never heard of. But the honky, Tim Devine, a graduate of Loyola Academy, another, you know, honky from that one of those wealthy enclaves around Loyola, I presume, is going to impose it on them anyway. But he's not an ideologue. And these individuals are, you know, advancing the understanding of the Beatitudes and what being a servant leader in the Catholic tradition means. Are you serious? Are you serious? And Loyola parents, I mean, some do because some contacted me. That's how I found out about it. But I mean, honestly, it just astounds me how people with means and intellect and who are engaged with their kids just let an institution as important as their school or schools just let them go. They just let them be taken over by these sentimental barbarians. It's astounding to me. I mean, if I had a kid, I probably wouldn't have a kid at Loyola because he'd be pulled, but I would be raising holy hell.
Some parents did.
Publicly, like on Green Bay Road, publicly. And, I mean, I appreciate the parents that feed information here, but these times require a bit more. Jack, Northwest Indiana.
So, of course, it occurs in, at Loyola. Where I suspect you will not have it occur is at Marist or at Brother Rice. Or at Mount Carmel, completely different demographic, the parents from where these students come from, they would not tolerate this. Of course, it has to occur in the North Shore. I'm done with that comment. Thanks.
Thanks for the call, Jack. Did I say Green Bay Avenue? Green Bay Road,
no,
obviously.
I thought you said Green Bay Road.
I'm sure. I don't know. For some reason, I thought I said Avenue. I sound like I'm an out-of-towner.
Yeah, you're forgetting your street names. No, you didn't say Avenue.
John in Bridgeport.
Just to piggyback off what the last caller said, I think that stuff does happen in Marist, but that's me personally.
Yeah.
Dan, I gotta tell you, what is it with the Jesuits from Georgetown to Loyola? They all do this, and they don't give any praise to Pope John Paul II. They wanted to get rid of Mother Angelica off the TV back in the 90s. What the heck is wrong with these people? I guarantee you there's more Jesuits burning in hell than any other demographic out there. But I wanted to tell you, I went to Mass this past Sunday, and the priest was a Jesuit priest, wanted to say a prayer for all the migrants that they may find their place here in America in society. I wanted to wring the guy's neck and be like, what about me trying to pay kids through college, through school? How about my prayer? Where's that at? But no, you always want to do that for someone that's in the minority, that's someone that's of a different color skin. The Jesuits suck, Dan, and you know it. Thanks for the call.
Wow.
Oh my God. Jesuits suck. That could be on Mount Carmel t-shirts next year when they play. They play Loyola, that is, of course. Yeah, I mean, I just think you have a lot of people in the Catholic priesthood and in the church whose real religion is sentimentality. And it makes them... Well, makes them barbarians. You're not immune to it because you're ordained. Chris, South Loop.
Yeah, it's an organ of power. And I think, yeah, there are sentimental barbarians, Dan, and hello, Amy, and thank you for everything you do. But, you know, the church was seen by the left as an organ of power in society, whether the Methodists got there on their own. But, you know, in the 1970s, the top Jesuit theologate in the United States, Weston, at Harvard in Massachusetts, was teaching. The doctrine was that to be a Christian, one had to first be a Marxist. I'm not kidding when I say that. I personal knowledge of that. And number two, you know, it's a twofer. Not only do you have the, you know, the kids are stuck there, so you can indoctrinate them, right? But in addition to that, you corrupt this entity, which theoretically is opposed to everything the Marxists want. That's why they sought to take it over from the inside by bastardizing, as you point out with your reference to liberation theology. You know, that's what St. Pope John Paul II was stopping when he took over as Pope, the so-called Medellin approach. But these guys slipped through, and I agree with it. Having grown up in Winnetka, most of my grade school friends went to Loyola, and I completely agree with the guy from Brother Rice or St. Rita. This would not go at 65th and Western.
Yeah.
There's no way you could peddle this BS. You have to be on Lake Avenue. It's like, as you know, Dan, Lake Avenue, Green Bay Road. You said it correctly. Yeah. You got to be up there with a soft-headed view of life and sort of like a Harvard MBA approach where you're applying wokeism in every facet of whatever, it's the country club you belong to.
Thanks for the call, Chris. Yeah, and right, and again, the whole Charles Murray distillation of places like the North Shore, which is they don't preach what they practice. I mean, the idea that meritocracy is something to be discarded, it would make no sense. And by the way, many of them wouldn't be living on the North Shore if that was true. But yet they're going along with the undermining of principles like that in the context of schooling and jobs and so forth. I mean, it's disgusting. That's what I'm saying. This is why they're the people deserving of the most contempt, because they know it's wrong. But the Loyola poltroons are afraid to say so. Because now where they're at, they'll be able to, you know, navigate their kids to wherever they need to be, and the hell with everybody else, including the country. Jim Northside.
Yeah, hi, Dan, Amy. Love you guys' show. Can I say, guys? Anyway, my son's a sophomore at Taft High School in Chicago, and he had that dumb course about 2 months ago. He came home and told me about it, and he was a little upset, a little confused about it. He didn't understand it, and I mean, I told him, listen, when you have crap like that, he has my permission to get on his phone in the middle of class or walk out. You know, I don't care what kind of trouble he gets into. But that's teaching that crap at Taft High School too.
Absolutely. Thanks for the call, Jim. Boy, that's going to sting the North Shore most of all, that their sophomore theology class is indifferent to what's being taught at Taft High School. I mean, I'm not taking a shot at Taft. I'm just saying, you know, the attitude. Loyola Academy and Taft High School are running the same curriculum? You think Loyola parents think that?
No.
Right. Right. Very helpful.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer.
Insert Democrat Socialist here.
Runs the Democratic House floor for 30 plus years running. He's promising this and he's stealing that. Where can you get that kind of money? He's using your house like his own piggy bank. Gang. You ought to know by now. You can pay off your house here in Illinois, but you can never keep up with the taxes. Oh, how it's always been the plan to have a taxpayer pay no doubt. Not a matter of if anymore, but when. You're moving out. I said, when you're moving out.
That theme music means it's time for our weekly confab with Ted Dabrowski, president of Wirepoints, wirepoints.org, all things Illinois policy related. Before we get to Ted, did you catch any of that Don Lamone interview with Elon Musk?
Yeah, I did.
Short-lived time on X. I don't know why Musk was like wanting to platform Don Lamone in the first place, but he was thoroughly disabused of that idea after spending an extended period of time with him.
Yeah, he just said no. But Don also had a list of demands. He wanted that truck, millions up front, and it wasn't going to work out, Dan.
This guy is unbelievable. This sort
of... What happened to Don, my friend?
I mean, it's unbelievable that... Just he is, as you're about to hear, he is just so vacuous. I know he's lazy, because I remember when he was lazy as a general assignment reporter for NBC5 in Chicago. And it's just so remarkable But I tell you, anything is possible in America. If Don Lemon can make millions of dollars, then maybe we're doing something wrong. But it just totally shows you, you know, hey, what the market will bear, I suppose, or what CNN will pay, one of the two.
Yeah, they paid him $26 million.
Excellent. This is a conversation, this interview that you may have caught bits and pieces of or whatnot. But this is Don Lemon and Elon talking about DEI, D-E-I, and how DEI kills because it lowers standards. And listen to this sort of simple concept that Musk is trying to communicate to Lemon and how, you know, just nonplussed Lemon is.
I believe that if we lower the standards for what it takes to become a doctor.
You're saying if we lower the standards, yes. But do you believe people are dying because the standards are being lowered?
I don't or have think been that lowered. Is, yes, an issue, but it could become an issue.
Okay. But the actual evidence in history shows the exact opposite. If you look at how minorities are treated by the medical system, most doctors now are white. And there are lots of mistakes in medicine. So you're saying that my doctors have bad medical care? I'm trying to understand your logic here when it comes to DEI, because there's no actual evidence of what you're saying.
No, I said, so if the standards, like let's say, I think that particular thing was referring to surgeons. Let's say a surgeon is asked to, a surgeon in training is asked to do a series of operations under the supervision of a senior surgeon, and they get a bunch of those operations wrong. If that happens, and yet they are still approved to be a surgeon, the probability that someone will die, I think, at some point is high.
Okay, I understand that, but that's a hypothetical. That doesn't mean it's happening.
I didn't say it's happening.
You didn't say it was happening.
I said it will.
But
I said if we lower standards, people will die.
But why respond to something or put something out there that has not happened? Because I could say, you know,
I don't want it to happen. I think we don't want to lower standards.
Okay, if you look at the history.
I
can't listen to that anymore.
Lower standards lowers quality, Don.
In every aspect of life, not only the medical profession, Don.
Right. It's not happening. First of all, it is happening.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, lower standards lowers quality. This is a foreign concept to Don Lemon. American Enterprise Institute, MCAT and GPA scores 2013 to 2016. I can only imagine where they are today. MCAT and GPA by race and then overlaid with the rate of admission. So, for example, an MCAT of 24 to 26 mm-hmm. and a GPA of 3.2 to 3.39. 56% of black applicants got admitted, 31% of Hispanic, 8% of white, 6% of Asian. The source is the Association of American Medical Colleges. Is that lowering the standard? MCAT of 27 to 29, GPA of 3.4 to 3.6. 81% of blacks admitted, 60% of Hispanics, 29% of whites, 21% of Asians. Again, Asians getting getting most short shrifted here. The point is this. Standards! That's the point. Merit. And then it's not happening. I mean, somebody needs to do the cross-sectional study of, like, the background of all the malpractice suits that where the insurance paid out or a doctor was found negligent or something, I guess, maybe to quantify this, to really bring this home. But the concept is really irrefutable, but it's being refuted nonetheless. It's not happening. And I can point to other times where minorities were treated bad by the medical profession. I'm sure. And that's wrong, too. The Tuskegee experiments. What does that have to do with how we're setting up the structure of education, training, for our future medical professionals? It has nothing to do with it, which is why, by the way, there's legislation sponsored by urologist, Murphy, out of North Carolina. He and Stanley Goldfarb, is a former associate med school dean and now the head of Do No Harm, legislation to eliminate dye from med schools for exactly the reason we're talking about. DEI. Poison. And it's dangerous. More on this, Ted. Thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Hey, good morning, Dan. Good morning, Amy.
We talked about the
DEI.
Yeah.
Just really, DEI should be struck from everywhere, and you know, it's used in our government every day now. It's what's fascinating to me is it makes it into things like budgets. You know, they'll tell you that you know, Lightfoot was really good at this and Pritzker too. But you know, in our budgets, we look at these things through an equity lens. So you know, forget actual numbers. We're going to do equity lens based budgeting, and of course that filters through everything now. So,
well, and we were talking about Loyola Academy, you know, so that's sort of a, you know, seemingly an innocuous example, this theology class at Loyola Academy, Wheel of Power and Privilege, and you're categorizing people as oppressor and oppressed based on their body size and race and skin color and gender identity and all this other stuff. But it's not just at Loyola Academy, as you've recently done a little review at Wire Points. And also the implications, boy, all of a sudden maybe they start to become a little bit more concrete, maybe they're a little bit more real when you're talking about med schools and future doctors.
Yeah, you know, and you're just talking about standards, and I think that the easiest one to see where it starts, you know, it starts way earlier, and you know, we can talk about like kids' sports and, you know, who gets the trophies and all that, but then, you know, moves right into the schools, and you know, we've been talking about this a lot, but you know, in the high schools and now talking about minorities, not just minorities, because there's whites too, but, you know, CPS graduates something like 80-something percent of blacks and Hispanics. And yet, you know, on the SAT, right, the standard form for measurement, you know, most of them are 17, 15, 20% of them can read at grade level or, you know, or pass, let's call it pass English on the SAT, and yet they're graduating 85%. So the standards are gone. And, you know, if you're a college and you cared about standards and you're getting kids from CPS, you wouldn't really know what you're getting anymore. But you know, most colleges don't care anymore either. So it's the whole chain. It goes from college, and then it goes to the DEI and companies, and it goes to DEI and doctors. It's destroying our system, and that's why DEI has to go.
Well, how is DEI playing out in Illinois schools?
Well, we wrote about that, and I think, you know, I keep running into people that don't really know what DEI is, or you know, most of them just, if they're not following, call it any kind of center right news, the center left doesn't cover it at all in the news, and so a lot of them just think it's benevolent stuff, and you know, they're in the Wilmette area, they think DEI is benevolent. It's, you know, come on, we're just talking about race, what's the big deal? But you know, you start to look at what's being taught in the schools, and you know, we looked at what was in New Trier over the last couple of years. And, you know, they start talking about privilege. Oh, it's kind of soft, you know, you're privileged. But, you know, talking to parents and talking to some kids, you start to realize that, you know, if this is talked about over and over again, that you're privileged, you're white, you're Christian, you are, you know, you have married parents. Well, you're lucky. You know, what you get and what you do is, it has nothing to do with your effort. It's all about your skin tone and your privilege. And the opposite is true. If you're not those things, then you are, you know, you're screwed. No matter how hard you try, you're screwed. And, you know, we posted on Wire Points this morning, kind of a lesson plan that they went through with kids in that. And, you know, it's just over and over and over. And when it becomes the message of every day of the oppressor and the oppressed, the victim and the, and, you know, and the oppressor, I don't know what you want people to think other than that something's screwed up.
Well, it's not just the message. It's the actual policies. It's who gets rewarded and for what reason. So, for example, I mean, Loyola Academy is a test in school. So what are they doing with respect to admittance, for example? Has anybody looked at that recently? I mean, so and then as you go next level, as you said, the college infrastructure that's built around this and the corporate infrastructure that's built around this. So then you're on a life track where this is always the basis on which decisions are being made, who advances and who doesn't, how we organize our daily business, whether it's in school or the real world. I mean, it's more than just, you know, idle chatter about race and privilege, doing some sort of retrospective of Western civilization. It's a little bit more serious than that.
Yeah, yeah, you're absolutely right. But I think the predicate for perpetuating that kind of stuff all the way through college and then work is making sure that everybody thinks that way, right? And so, you know, we also found that Nutrient is happening elsewhere, Evanston and others. They're creating these affinity groups. And, you know, they're segregating groups. It sounds okay. You know, the blacks will talk to the blacks and the Hispanics will be with the Hispanics. And the whites, not the normal whites, but the anti-racist whites will get together. And so what you're doing is you're creating more and more division. And I loved when this personnel, I'm forgetting his name right now, Peter Kersenow, who's from the Civil Rights Commission, you know, he came out and slammed Evanston for segregating teachers, and then of course later segregating students, you know, and just saying that you're encouraging people to look at each other as members of groups and not individuals, and not just groups but rival groups, right? You know, grievance. It's just so toxic and so dangerous as you move up the chain, because this is how kids are being taught to think. And They're not pushing back many of them aren't pushing back when they move into the corporate world and the university world.
On this election day, what are you watching? Let me guess, school referenda.
We're certainly watching that. That's one because, we've seen a little bit of pushback by the groups. You know, is it ever enough for those opposing tax hikes and you know, big old, you know, hundreds of millions of spending? So we're certainly watching that. I think it'll be interesting to watch the state's attorney's race, not because I think there'll be a big difference between the two, but it will be interesting to see whether you heard a lot of Republicans saying they're going to cross over and vote in the pull a Democratic ballot and vote for Eileen O'Neill Burke. So that'll be interesting to see. And I think that, of course, the bring home Chicago, that'll be it should pass easily because, again, you've pit 96% of the people against the few that get hurt by the higher real estate tax. So, but I'd say no big changes, right? Nothing's going to dramatically change off of this election in Chicago, except for if they do pass that tax hike, it's going to be more pain on the real estate market.
What are you hearing though? Do you think a lot of Republicans are going to be pulling Democratic ballots?
I think so. I've heard a lot of people saying that. I think a lot of people have been wooed by her commentary. It's certainly what she says is better than what Clayton Harris says, but you know, there's really not any differences, enough differences to make a difference between the two. So, but I think people may feel good about it, and I think it's a wrong message to send. I think it's wrong to say, "Hey, I helped her in there," because I think most of what she's about is preserving the status quo. Maybe just not as you know, obsessively as Fox, for example.
Well, here's one of her closing 10-second arguments.
Oh, no, the justice system's not working right now. If you're happy with things are, then vote for my opponent, because he hasn't been in a courtroom in 20 years and wants to keep everything the same.
Yeah, well, the problem is that some of the people who have been in the courtroom for the last 20 years are just as bad. Ted Dabrowski, president of WirePoints, wirepoints.org. Thanks as always, Ted. Appreciate it.
Thank you, guys.
Thank you, and he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
The stories you need to know to start your day. This is Chicago's Morning Answer on AM 560, The Answer. This is Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan Proft and Amy Jacobson on AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy, in an important First Amendment case that in which oral arguments were heard yesterday, talking about Missouri v. Murthy, of course. We've been talking about it for months and months. One key exchange was between Justice Ketanji Brown Jackson and the Louisiana Solicitor General. Listen to this exchange, because I think it's it's sort of a disturbing perspective Jackson is telegraphing about our First Amendment freedoms.
Biggest concern is that your view has the First Amendment hamstringing the government in significant ways in the most important time periods. I mean, what would you have the government do? I've heard you say a couple times that the government can post its own speech, but in my hypothetical, kids, this is not safe, don't do it, is not going to get it done. And so I guess some might say that the government actually has a duty to take steps to protect the citizens of this country, and you seem to be suggesting that that duty cannot manifest itself in the government encouraging or even pressuring platforms to take down harmful information. So can you help me? Because I'm really worried about that, because you've got the First Amendment operating in an environment of threatening circumstances from the government's perspective, and you're saying that the government can't interact with the source of those problems.
And, Your Honor, I understand that instinct, and I guess what I tell you is our position is not that the government can't interact with the platforms there. They can and they should in certain circumstances like that that present such dangerous issues for society and especially young people. But the way they do that has to be in compliance with the First Amendment. And I think that means they can give them all the true information that the platform needs and ask to amplify that.
Right, but you're just saying that. I guess I thought, when you say the way they do that is consistent with the First Amendment, is that they have to show that they have a compelling interest to do what they're doing. In other words, you want us to take the line to be between compulsion and encouragement. And what we're looking at is the government can't compel, maybe they can encourage. I'm wondering whether that's not really the line. The line is, does the government, pursuant to the First Amendment, have a compelling interest in doing things that result in restricting the speech in this way? That test, I think, takes into account all of these different circumstances, that we don't really care as much about how much the government is compelling, or maybe we do, but in the context of tailoring and not as sort of a freestanding inquiry that's overlaid on all of this. Does that make sense?
It does, Your Honor, and I apologize for missing your guidance earlier. So the way I think about that is I've been discussing the standard, and I thought we've all been discussing the standard on the front end of the analysis, which is there a First Amendment violation? Is there an abridgment of speech? I guess I would conceptually think of strict scrutiny, narrow tailing, compelling interest as coming in at the back end to say, yes, maybe in the ordinary case, the government shouldn't have been permitted to undertake the kind of suppression of free speech that it did, but in this unique circumstance, it actually had a compelling interest, and it used narrowly tailored means to accomplish that interest. I mean, I think that's the fail-safe. If you're concerned with the breadth of our arguments, that's one fail-safe, which is no matter how broad the standard the court adopts, there's always going to be strict scrutiny at the end of the line to save the government in times where it desperately needs to do the things that you're outlining.
Thank you.
Thank you, mm-hmm. Counsel.
Michael Schellenberger noted that he worried about this being a predicate to state censorship or greater state censorship. And so do I. Schellenberger, of course, one of the Twitter Files reporters. For more on this, please be joined by Jed Rubenfeld. He's a professor of law at Yale, an expert on constitutional law and First Amendment rights, also the author of The Interpretation of Murder. Professor Rubenfeld, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, happy to be here.
So isn't Ketanji Brown Jackson sort of insinuating a more expansive prior restraint power for the federal government?
Well, the clip you played is one of the most worrisome, troublesome exchanges in an oral argument I've ever heard. And it was very disheartening to hear that. Let me say a couple of things by way of real quick background. Number one, I'm a lawyer in that case. I'm involved in the litigation, just full disclosure. Bobby Kennedy Jr. is a plaintiff in that litigation. I'm his lawyer. Just so, you know, everybody okay. knows that I'm
good to know.
A lawyer in that case. But
are you going to be his running mate as well?
Yeah, right. but what she's saying is she's invoking what's known as the compelling state interest test. And in exceptional cases, the government's allowed to, according to current law, is allowed to violate our constitutional rights in extremely exceptional circumstances if there's a so-called compelling state interest and what they're doing is very narrowly tailored. Mm-hmm. Now, you got to understand, the government itself did not argue that in this case. No one has argued, not even the government itself, that what it did could be justified under this compelling state interest test, because what they did was not narrowly tailored at all. And if Justice Jackson thinks that what the government did in this case, which is having a, you know, like 80 to 100 analysts calling up the platforms several times a week and telling them what to take down, and pressuring them and working with them to censor protected speech, if she thinks that that's, you know, going to be something that the compelling state interest test can justify, we're all in big trouble. So that's a very worrisome thing. Even the government itself had not argued it, and I was very disappointed to hear Justice Jackson making that argument. I can tell you this, you know, a couple of years ago, you could not say on Facebook, on Twitter, on Google, you could not say that the COVID virus might have originated in a lab in Wuhan, China.
Right.
Now, what compelling state interest did the government have in not letting people say that? All it was doing was pushing its own political agenda and stopping people from speculating about what, you know, turned out to be a very strong, plausible explanation of the origins of the virus. And the idea that the government can tell folks they can't say that, you know, and that Americans were not permitted to say such a thing on you know, the social media platforms for like 6 months in 2020. That was, you know, it's what, you know, what country are we living in? And that you cannot possibly get to the compelling state interest test to justify something like that.
Well, the other thing, too, is how the state went about pursuing this compelling interest that Ketanji Brown Jackson thinks it had. They didn't say we have a compelling state interest. We're calling on social media companies to make sure they promote the vaccine and they don't platform theories about its origination in Wuhan or whatever, you know, the mitigations and so on and so forth. It didn't do that. It did this surreptitiously, pressuring them behind closed doors, using state power, as some argued, maybe with as Alito argued, you know, we've got this Section 230 in our pocket, so you better go along. To the extent there was pushback, and oftentimes there wasn't, they were sort of colluding. But I mean, they didn't make this open and notorious that this is what we believe, and so we're acting under this theory. They did it all in a clandestine manner, which goes to, you know, a belief, I think a reasonable belief, that they knew what they were doing was wrong. They knew they couldn't do it themselves, so they used a cutout.
Well, you're exactly right about that, and it's extremely important. No, just so everybody understands, there's two things the government's not allowed to do in these contexts. First, it can't coerce, and that's what everybody was talking about at the oral argument, and that's kind of what you're talking about too. You can't threaten and say, look, if you don't do what we want you to do, we're going to, you know, maybe pull your 230 protection, or maybe we'll come after you under the antitrust laws. That's called coercion. That's a threat. And everybody understands that the government cannot do that, and if they did that, which, you know, they were found – The Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals found they did do that. Mm-hmm. And if they did that, that's unconstitutional. They cannot get Facebook to censor speech by threatening them. But the other thing that they can't do, and there was no talk about this at the oral argument yesterday, and it was very disappointing, they're not allowed to get in there and do what's called joint activity, a joint action. That is, get in there and involve themselves so closely that they become participants, joint participants in the platform's censorship decisions, what particular stuff to take down, what censorship policies they should have. And there was tons of evidence that that's what they did. They got in there and they became co-partners. The platforms were even referring to themselves as partners with the government agencies in deciding what speech Americans could not say, what facts they couldn't dare to utter, what viewpoints they couldn't dare to express. And I was shocked that the lawyers didn't push that, and that the justices didn't see it, and because the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals found that was violated too. That rule was violated too. There was joint action in this case, and you know, I think we should have heard more about that yesterday as well.
Well, you can't suspend the Constitution because they said what, COVID's a once in a lifetime event.
You know, people who want to suppress free speech always want to suspend the Constitution. That's what the real problem with Justice Jackson's line of thought is. Folks who want to curtail speech always think that they have the best of reasons for doing so, that national security depends on it, that compelling state interests depend on it. Everybody who wants to suppress free speech always thinks that. And the courts are there, and the First Amendment is there to say, no, you can't do that.
Right, and not to mention, in this case, with respect to COVID, it turns out the people, some of the people whose speech they were suppressing, like Dr. Jay Bhattacharya and Dr. Martin Kulldorff, were more accurate when it came to COVID than the powers that be that were guiding the social media companies when it came to tailoring what speech was allowed and what speech wasn't.
You have that right again, and we should have heard more about that yesterday. So the doctor whom you're mentioning, the Stanford scientist, Jay Bhattacharya, he and a few others wrote the famous Great Barrington Declaration saying lockdowns are the wrong way to go here. We have a disease that is mostly, unfortunately, you know, tragically, the death rate for older and ill people was much higher. Why are we locking down the healthier people? And that was a serious public policy debate that should have gotten much more play. Now, years later, most people are coming around to their position that the lockdowns were a disastrous failure, and yet they were suppressed. These were public policy arguments. They were dissenters. They were saying the current policy on COVID is wrong, and you're not saving lives, and that we live in a country where all of a sudden you couldn't say that. You couldn't have a public policy debate about that. That's not how you satisfy compelling state interest. You satisfy compelling state interest by letting the facts out and letting people argue and debate their opinions. And what we saw in 2020 and 2021 was exactly the opposite.
Well, we got you because this just came over the transom. What do you think the prospects are for Trump in terms of finding success with a defamation suit against ABC and George Stephanopoulos for his characterization of Trump in an interview he did with Nancy Mace that you may have seen, where he pressed Nancy Mace, a rape survivor, as to how she could support someone who was found to have been liable for rape in that civil case?
Yeah. Well, I tell you, when public figures like former President Trump try, and many others as well, try to sue folks for defamation, they run into a legal doctrine which makes it extremely difficult.
Actual malice.
Yeah, they got to show what's called actual malice, and folks sometimes don't understand that word. It doesn't mean ill will. It doesn't mean, you know, like somebody doesn't like somebody else. It means you have to show the person who libeled you actually knew that what they were saying was false when they said it. You almost have to show that's how high the bar is, and it makes it so difficult. A lot of people think that doctrine should be changed, and a couple of justices on the Supreme Court have indicated that they might want to reconsider that. But right now, that's the law, and it makes any such suit extremely difficult.
He is Jed Rubenfeld, of course, professor of law at Yale Law School. Bobby Kennedy Jr.'s lawyer, as we heard. An expert on con law and First Amendment rights. He's the author of The Interpretation of Murder. Professor Rubenfeld, thanks as always for joining us. Appreciate it.
Oh, it was a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
Listen to Dan and Amy on your smartphone. Download the AM560 mobile app today at 560theanswer.com/mobile. If you're looking for the latest news, insight into what it means, and the sharpest opinion, there's only one station in Chicago where you can turn, and it's this one. We're AM 560, The Answer.
Top of the morning, Dan and Amy. You know, the left has a zero tolerance policy for even the insinuation of political violence, except when they do it. And when their opponents don't do it, that's still not good enough if their opponent is Trump, if they can make something of it. Here's a former Trump fanboy, Joe Scarborough.
He's talking about a bloodbath for America. It's laid out in the terms of it. And these idiots on Twitter, these idiots on cable news, these idiots on Sunday shows, going, well, yeah, well, presidents, you know, he was talking only about the auto industry. And this is one more. It's just bull. Let me say that at 6:15 a.m. It's just bull. He knew what he was doing. We're not stupid. Americans aren't stupid. He was talking about a bloodbath. Sometimes a bloodbath means a bloodbath. And when he finishes by saying, and that's just going to be the least of it, seriously, these people may be stupid. We're not.
No, one thing we know is Joe Scarborough and Mika are not stupid.
That's the dumbest show on television.
They're just...
by far, worse than The View.
Well, they're leftiest marionettes whose strings are being pulled for, I don't know, their supper and in service of a small constituency that likes the Trump fear porn on a daily basis.
Right, but the left has been using bloodbath for decades. They use it all the time. I don't know if you want to hear this again, but just give me 10 seconds.
But as Politico.com reports tonight on the, quote, bloodbath at the RNC.
Headlines calling it a, quote, bloodbath.
A bloodbath. Not only is it going to be a bloodbath, but after they leave New Hampshire, it's a bloodbath on her home turf.
Everything's been a bloodbath. But then Trump says it, and they take him out of context, and they blow it out of the water.
It's a positively quotidian term in politics, in sports, in life. It was a bloodbath out there. You know, we got our brains beat in at basketball game or what. Yes. I mean, it's just so over the top. The thing that most bothers me is why does Morning Joe, why do they get to use bull blank and I have to use bull jive?
Well, when did Scarborough get a mouth on him? Like,
do they do they get different FCC rules than we do? Well, we need somebody to look into that, because if I can go full potty mouth, and you know, I want to.
That's when indulge. You know they're losing.
I want to indulge, too. No, I mean, the hysteria is laughable, but it's prompted an ad. And then now you got a comparison to their mischaracterization of what Trump said in Charlottesville. And then they'll bolt something else on that they're able to misconstrue purposefully at a future rally and so on and so forth. It's all in service to end days for America if Trump is elected. But is that going to be enough? I don't think so. But something else that does concern me and I've expressed for a while now, I think Trump should get farther ahead of this than he is. There's a Ipsos poll that was commissioned by Politico. A plurality of independent respondents in this survey said a conviction in Manhattan would have no impact on the likelihood to support Trump for president. But a third of independents said they would be less likely to support Trump if he were convicted in Manhattan. And I focus on Manhattan because that's the only case likely to go to trial before the election. And so if you extrapolate that across the nation and swing states, losing a third of independents on this issue. And again, it's a third of 18-year-olds, not necessarily registered voters. I don't like this poll. Other than to say, look, we've seen other polling earlier that shows there's a potential problem here. It's not an insurmountable one, but it's a potential problem. And I think Trump needs to be front running this a little bit more than he has been. For more on all of this, we're pleased to be joined by Mark Hemingway. He's a senior writer at RealClearInvestigations.com and a book editor at The Federalist. Mark, thanks for joining us. Appreciate it.
Glad to be here.
What's your perspective on the bloodbath over bloodbath?
Well, it's just an absolute desperation move. I mean, basically, at this point in time, we have a situation here where the polls have been solidifying for months now, with Trump comfortably ahead, both in swing states and in national polling, and even worse for Democrats. If you look at those polls, it shows that Biden and the Democrats' support is eroding heavily with Hispanics and Black people. And so they're basically just hitting the panic button, and they're doing anything they can to sort of like change the narrative around the race. Now, obviously, for anyone that's been paying attention for the past 8 years, we know that Trump traffics in hyperbole. And it's not even necessarily a Trump thing. I mean, has anyone spent any time in the Bronx or any of these places where, you know, Trump is from? And this is just a normal sort of way of discourse, never mind that politics uses, you know, violent and martial metaphors all the time. I mean, it's just positively absurd. They're just desperate for anything to catch fire with the public that will have them talking about how bad Trump is. But, you know, the public's totally inured to Trump's way of speaking about this sort of thing, never mind that even as far as Trump's, you know, speaking goes, what he said with the bloodbath comment isn't even all that shocking.
Right. Well, do you agree with me that the possibility of a conviction is the only real wild card left that could potentially change the trajectory of this race?
It could. It depends on how the trial goes down. But I would say that's not a big possibility at this point in time. You got to remember, he's already been convicted of sexual assault, and he's still flying high in the polls. Now, granted, that whole sexual assault trial was, you know, sexual basically abuse. A joke. You know, we can't even, you know, the woman who brought the charges was, you know, obviously a bit loony. The whole case is bankrolled by an anti-Trump billionaire, and she couldn't even remember, like, you know, when this alleged horrible assault took place.
Being a convicted felon is a different thing, though. It's a different thing.
You might be right. You know, I might be totally wrong about this. I just think that you know, I don't think that this is going to make much of a difference in terms of people's opinions. I mean, basically, the problem is Democrats have almost overplayed their hand here with this lawfare stuff. And they're coming at them with, you know, all these different cases. And at some point, it looks like the system is just out to get them. And if anything, you know, Trump has, you know, risen in the polls because of all these lawsuits. Now, I don't know, maybe the trial might be different. Maybe being a quote-unquote felon might be different. But I don't think at this point in time that the narrative is already baked in that the establishment is out to get him no matter what. And I don't think it's going to change the dynamic of the race all that much.
Yeah, with the E. Jean Carroll, I mean, they changed the statute of limitations so she could file a civil suit where he was found liable of sexual abuse, not sexual assault. But that's just one example of, you know, because I was on the Trump fence, but now I'm all in for Trump. Because of all these court cases against him.
Yeah, and I think a lot of voters view it that way, too. You know, they are sick and tired of the D.C. establishment always getting its way on things. And when it looks like, you know, you've got this, you know, coordinated effort across the country to get him for political reasons rather than legitimate ones. You know, and the other thing is, you know, even if this trial does convict him as, you know, a felon or, you know, somehow it's different, you have all these situations where, like, the terms of that, you know, quote-unquote financial fraud case, you know, the facts of the E. Jean Carroll case. I mean, these are all things that look really, really, you know, flimsy and bad and, you know, ginned up. So, you know, even if there was something that did appear to have more substance in that context, it's going to be lessened in my view. But, you know, I don't know. You know, a lot can happen between, you know, here and November. So we'll just have to see.
Well, so, I mean, so what does concern you then if you're looking at it from Trump's perspective? Is it, I don't know, maybe getting a significant percentage of some 5, 7, 10 million people in this country illegally to cast ballots somehow?
Well, you know, obviously that is a huge concern. And, you know, I would say the issue with the election itself is a concern in the sense that elections are no longer, you know, self-motivated, you know, interested citizens showing up on election day to vote. It's become this giant nationwide ballot harvesting operation. And even though the Republican Party and some other people are scrambling to get ahead of that, we're still way behind where Democrats are in terms of, you know, what we saw in 2020, where they just went out and they just deployed these, you know, surgical machines using, you know, very precise data to go into the, you know, the swingiest areas of swing states and cultivate just enough votes that they could win. And Republicans haven't caught up to that. Now, having said that, Biden's erosion in the polls is so great that I'm not sure that kind of, you know, their ability to change the vote is mostly marginal. And Biden might well be well outside the margins at this point in time. So, and the other thing is, you know, 2020 was really a unique year. You had nationwide riots. You had, you know, the coronavirus. You had all these things. I mean, they threw everything they could at Trump. And Biden still only won by 40,000 votes across three states in the Electoral College. The idea that they're going to be able to repeat something like that seems, you know, somewhat unlikely to me. But, you know, I'm trying to stay vigilant here.
All right. Well, I'm gonna end on that guarded optimism. We don't get to do that too much. Mark Hemingway, senior writer at RealClearInvestigations.com, book editor at The Federalist. Mark, thanks as always.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you. And he joined us on our turnkey.pro answer line.
It's what Chicago is talking about. It's Chicago's Morning Answer with Dan and Amy on AM 560, The Answer.
Thanks for listening to Chicago's Morning Answer podcast, sponsored by Signature Bank. Signature Bank takes pride in helping customers grow their business and provide unmatched banking expertise, custom financial solutions, and the industry's best technology. So whether you're a business looking for a deposit relationship or needs a ready source of financing, Signature Bank is the right bank for you. Call today at 773-467-5600 to hear how Signature Bank can help your business grow and thrive. Member FDIC, Equal Housing Lender.